I think, I don't know if that was a compliment or not, but we sang some old songs tonight. Did you notice the dates on those? 1700s? I think the first one was the 1500s, actually. And then we sang a real modern one, 1867, then went back to one from the mid-1700s. It's interesting how intelligent and talented those songwriters were from so long ago. We sometimes look back in history and think we've progressed a lot and everything modern's better, but boy, those people knew the Scripture. And they had some pretty deep thoughts. And I hope our melody in our hearts tonight centered around those wonderful scriptural thoughts. In fact, one song actually from the text of the New Testament. So I hope that was as meaningful to you as to me. And I appreciate the selection of those songs. That's always the case, really, with the song leaders here. We have decided, along with our theme this year, which is on looking at Jesus, who is our master, our teacher, and the one to whom we look to see God. John began his gospel by saying that no man had seen God at any time, but the Son has revealed Him to us. And we see in the Son the glory of God. Jesus has said then that the disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher, Luke 6 and verse 40. And we've taken that as our theme this year. And part of that exercise in looking at Jesus as the pattern for our lives is every month we have picked a particular quality of Jesus and used that as a topic to do on a Sunday night lesson. And I got the one called The Diligence of Jesus. I was trying to remember who put that one on the list. I know Sewell came to me and said, why don't you do the one on the, we couldn't remember the word for it, right? It was the dedication of Jesus, something like that. It was the diligence of Jesus. I think I put that one on the list, actually. So I have only myself to blame. And I will just say to you that what I had in mind really was that it was going to be a lesson on how busy Jesus kept himself, on how he managed his time, on how he just seemed to have enough energy, or if he didn't, he would wear himself out in things that were worth doing. And of course, I started to feel guilty just thinking about that topic, right? How often do we not do what we ought to do? We don't manage our time, right? And we fritter away the minutes of the day, and we are ending the day, maybe we're worn out having done all the wrong things. And so as I start to think about, where's the text for this? And really, if you do the typical sermon preparation and do a concordance search for the word diligence, it's found quite often. Give diligence to be approved of God, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, and that's a New King James Version. Give diligence to make your calling and election sure, I think 2 Peter 1, several other passages. And we'll look at some of those passages. But really, how would I describe the diligence of Jesus? So we'll talk about the definition of that for just a minute. Let me start off by saying, I think it's pretty clear the opposite of that diligence is slothfulness. In the Proverbs, for example, a passage like, there are many passages, as you know, on the lazy man or the sluggard. He who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So I think we could just start and almost get that point out of the way, that if we're not busy, if we are lazy, you remember Jesus called the one talent man who just buried his talent in the sand. He says, you wicked and slothful servant. That's bad. If we're not busy and working, we're not anywhere near what Jesus was doing. However, just to say we're busy is not good enough really to define what I think the diligence of Jesus is. The diligence of Jesus is not, and you might put the word simply, but it's not just being busy and energetic. Do you remember what Jesus said to Martha? It says, in fact, in that account, I think it's Luke's account, where Mary and Martha were there, Jesus was teaching. Martha was distracted with much serving. She was busy. In fact, Jesus goes on to say, Martha, you are anxious and worried or something about that with many things. That was not a compliment to her. And the rest of the story was that Mary had chosen the good part. So just the fact that we're busy, and I think as Americans, especially as proud as we are of whatever the Protestant work ethic is, I know at work it's a kind of a badge of honor to talk about how many hours you've worked, how little sleep you got, and how many things you're doing. Y'all know what I mean. That's just an accepted American virtue, I suppose, to always be busy, always be anxious. It's really not even being able to work on lots of things. In fact, that might really be the criticism of Martha. She was doing all kinds of things. But you remember, in the parable of the soils, or the parable of the sowers, Jesus calls it. The seed that fell on the thorny ground were those people who accepted the word, but then it just was choked out with lots of other things. And it was choked out so that it bore no fruit. So it's not really just that we're working on lots of things. It's not that we're skillful or accurate or fast. And that by that I mean by that is we're not just busy, we actually produce something. We see good results. You remember that the parable of talents, some of those men had fewer things. And the body is described as some are good at some things and some are good at other things. So that's really not a criteria I think God is placing on us, that we've got to be good at everything, and we can't make any mistakes, and we've got to be talented in whatever we do. And I don't think it's really just the fact that we're wearing ourselves out. Now, I want to stop and say that Jesus was all these things. You know that, right? The master teacher. Everything, he was busy all the time. He was accurate in what he said and what he did. He was able to do many things in his life, and he wore himself out in his service. There are several passages that almost picture that. The account, I think it's in Mark 4, where there's a long sermon, and at the end of that thing, he is going to get in a boat and go across the water, and there's going to be a storm on the sea. But the language, I think, is Mark uses that they took him as he was, almost as if they had to carry him almost, got in the boat, and what did he do? He fell asleep right away in a storm, in a frightening storm. Clearly wore himself out in that regard. And other images, I think, of his agony and his suffering having to do with the great mission that he had, not least of which, of course, is the garden. But I still don't think that's what the message would be, and I puzzled over how to approach this lesson, but we're studying the book of John in the old auditorium class, the adult class, and I came across a couple of passages which just seem to bring this idea of what the diligence of Jesus really ought to be, what it was for him, and what it was for us. And I want to talk about those two passages. We'll have to treat them together, and you might want to go ahead and turn to John chapter 9, and you can begin to find those. As we look at these passages, I think it's the case that as Jesus did His work, which if you know from the book of John, when Jesus talks about I work and the Father works, or believe the works that I do if you don't believe the words, He's often talking about the miracles that He has done. And in John, there are not a lot of miracles listed, really only 7 that you would think of as miracles. And each one seems to be very deliberately planned and carefully orchestrated, and even the teaching around the miracle is often oriented around the very act itself, the work that He had done. So thinking of the works that Jesus did in John, especially as the miracles, it's interesting to look at John chapter 9 and John chapter 11 as the context. And what I want to look at is why Jesus did what He did, what exactly He did, when He did it, and then another one you'll just have to wait till you get there to see what I mean by whenever. But that's what we'd like to look at. And I'd like to look really beginning in John 9. And I want to back up, first of all, a little bit of a context for both of these texts. John 9 is the healing of the man born blind. And we've learned that in the class because it almost rhymes. John 9, man born blind. But it comes at the last 6 months of Jesus' ministry. It actually seems to take place around the Feast of the Tabernacles, which would have been in October. And the following spring, April, was when Jesus was crucified. So 6 months before the end of His teaching and ministry on the earth. The second miracle, the raising of Lazarus from the dead, and forgive me if I say healing of Lazarus, but the raising of Lazarus from the dead in chapter 11 occurred sometime after the Feast of Dedication, which was in December. So that could have been January, February, maybe even into March, maybe only weeks before the crucifixion, but they both were during the last half of a year of Jesus' time on the earth. And by then, especially in Jerusalem, the opposition of the Jewish leaders had grown to a peak. And you can see that here, just backing up in chapter 8 before chapter 9 begins. Verse 59, they took up stones to throw at Him, but He hid Himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. That's not the first time that's happened. And their plans to arrest Him in chapter 7 earlier at the Feast of Tabernacles are an illustration of that. John 9:1. Now, as Jesus passed by, He saw a man who was blind from birth. And His disciples asked Him, saying, Rabbi, Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it's day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. So we'll skip over the miracle. It's an interesting chapter, really. And it shows the pervasiveness of belief and unbelief and how a sign as magnificent as something never been done since the beginning of time, according to the blind man, would tend to harden the unbelievers into further unbelief and would actually confirm those who had believed into further belief. But interesting chapter. We'll look at that. Now let's pass forward maybe 3, 4, 5 months to John chapter 11. And now once again you can see the opposition that has grown here in Jerusalem. And Jesus actually is staying across the Jordan over on the eastern side to stay out of Jerusalem because of the threats that had been made. And his time, or as we'll see later, his hour had not yet come. But look at 10, verse 31. The Jews took up stones again to stone him. And he challenged them, said, for what good work do you stone me? By the way, this was at the Feast of Dedication, which would have been a month or two before the raising of Lazarus. And then down to verse 39. Therefore, they sought again to seize him, but he escaped out of their hand. And he went away beyond the Jordan to a place where John was baptizing at first. And there he stayed. Many came to him and said, John performed no sign, but all the things that John spoke about this man were true. And many believed in him there. Now, a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Now, when Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days. When he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go into Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you. And we saw that in the previous chapter. And you, are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of the world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. So these are the two texts. And what I'd like to do is we talk about the why and the what and the when and the whatever. I would like to kind of go back to these verses that I put on the screen here and look at those and see how they address each of those points. First of all, why did Jesus do what he did? And what lesson can we learn from the way he was motivated in all that he did, but in particular as he expresses it in these two cases? Look here at this text in John chapter 9, verse 4. He says, I must work the works of him who sent me. I must. There's a divine compulsion, is a term that I read somewhere. This idea that God is calling you to do this and it's pushing you. And he says, it's the works of him who sent me. Do you understand the significance of that? I think maybe in our little worlds where we have bosses or important people, and the big boss who comes all the way down from the corner office to your office and says, I need you to do this project for me. Now, does that get priority over things that you might have done just because you thought they were good to do? Well, of course it does. Someone important has asked you to do something. You're on a mission that's been endorsed, requested, and accountability is created to someone who is in a place of a great power. So I think the very first thing to say is that the God of the universe has caused these works to be commanded. That's the thing Jesus was going out to do. In our lives, when we have things that we need to do, Ben talked this morning about the pressing need to talk to others about the gospel. But it could be our own personal growth. You have to come up with an application you can hold on to as we think through this idea of diligence in doing what we need to do. But it may be that you have some particular habit or some sin that needs to be overcome. It could be that you have children that you're rearing in your life. It could be you're being of service to others who are in need, either health-wise or in other ways. It could be that you have a marriage that's in trouble, that needs to be improved. It could be there's a relationship that you have with another brother that needs healing. These are the works of the Father. Do you understand that God is calling you to do that? It's not the elders of this church. It's something that is put on us as a work of God. And there's this divine imperative to do the things that God tells us to do. Isn't it really true, and I don't know how many times I've said this and thought it way more times, we have less problem knowing what to do than just getting motivated to do it. One thing that motivates, of course, is to know who it is that calls on us to do those things. This is typical of Jesus' life. You remember when he was 12 years old and they were looking for him when they had returned to headed back up to Galilee. They said, he says, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my Father's business?" Earlier in his ministry, but also in the book of John, he came across the Samaritan woman and he talked with her, and the disciples came back and they said, "Well, has he been had something to eat?" And he said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." I think we could also say that it was his job to do the Father's will and not his own. Now, that's a little bit strange, and I don't fully understand the operation of the Trinity, but it is important that there are two persons in the Trinity that are working together here. The Spirit has a role as well, but the Son and the Father have a relationship which perhaps at one point was equal. But at this point, the Son is voluntarily submitting himself to the Father's will. And in the book of John, that comes out all the time. "I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me." And in John 13, "Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him." And now in this last text, he's describing his role with respect to the Father, but he's also describing the role of the disciples with respect to him. That's very similar to our theme verse, as Bill Christian pointed out in our class this morning. Jesus has just washed the disciples' feet, and he's basically saying, you know what? A servant really is not greater than the one who sent him. In the same way, Jesus has subjected himself to the Father. What's the lesson to us? How often is it that we decide what to do based on what's best for us, or what's comfortable to us, or what would give us the best advantage, or cause us the least problem or the least expense? The example of Jesus in doing these works is not to do his own will, but to do the will of the Father, willingly, voluntarily submitting his own good and his own will to the Father's will. And of course, that comes to a culmination in that he learned obedience, not that he didn't know what it was, but he had never experienced it really. This true obedience that calls on someone to submit, subject their own will, to take harm on themselves for the sake of another, he experienced that. He learned obedience through the things that he suffered, as the Hebrew writer said. So, looking again at the motivation, the why, yes, God is the source of that command, but is there more to this story? And Ben's lesson this morning was dead on this point. Why do we do what we do? That the works of God should be revealed in him. That's John 9, the prelude to healing the blind man. But looking at John 11 more particularly, he said that the reason this sickness has come upon Lazarus, and the reason I suppose that he tarried 2 days and allowed Lazarus to die, which was painful. It was painful to Mary and Martha. It was painful to Jesus. You see his emotional reaction when he finally returns to Bethany. But the reason was so that the glory of God could be revealed. Is it possible that revealing the glory of God should take a subordinate role to our own comfort and our own pain? It seems like in this miracle, Jesus allows these events to happen in order that the glory of God could be revealed. We'll say a little bit more about that later. But the point is that not only does he have the imperative from the Creator of the universe, it's a glorious, literally, glorious mission. It's something that brings, it's worth doing. Do you know how motivating that is? It's not just the big boss came down, but boy, this could save the company, or some grand mission that has a purpose and a value that we can see. Now go back to those examples again. I think about rearing children as something that we sometimes just, we don't put the value on it that we should. These are souls that God has entrusted to us. And you think of passages like, anyone that caused the least of these to stumble, right, it's better the millstone be put around his neck. This is significant work. Service to others who cannot return that service. You see how important that is? Do we see those kinds of tasks as showing the glory of God? Ben did a good job with that this morning. Speaking to someone about the gospel, it's hard for me to picture this bright light of God's glory shining out when we do that, but that's what it is. And if we see who said it, and we see the great glory that's revealed to the world because of what we're doing, it would be a motivator to us. And it makes us diligent, makes us do what we should do. And that's what Jesus said. He said, I'm doing the works of the Father who sent me. And it's to show His glory. That's why I'm doing it. So that's the why. But what did Jesus do? Can we learn from that? Let's look at these texts again. At least the one in John chapter 9 this time. He says, I have to do the works of God. And He said, the works of Him who sent me. The suggestion there is that, and we'll see this in many other verses, we won't look at all of them, but there are in other places, Jesus saying that, I'm only doing what the Father told me to do. Let's look at some of those passages. The Son can do nothing of Himself, but what He sees the Father do. For whatever He does, the Son also does in like manner. John 8:28. When you lift up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am He, and that I do nothing of Myself, but as My Father taught Me, I speak these things. For I have not spoken on My own authority, but the Father who sent Me gave Me a command what I should say and what I should speak. If you just look at those words, what commands the Father had given, what He had heard the Father say, what He had seen in the Father, do these sound familiar as far as the way we establish our practice and authority in religion? The Father told Him to do something. That's what He does. He saw it in the Father. That's what He does. The Father said it. That's what He teaches. You understand that teaching was Jesus' primary mission, primary activity. What did He say? Only what the Father said. Is that the way our religious work should be? Our work for God, taking only what He says, nothing of our own, even as smart as we think we are, as innovative as we could be. Jesus worked the works of the Father, and that's all. And if His wisdom, equal with God, was limited by what the Father said and what He saw in the Father and what the Father taught and commanded, should not our limited wisdom, our minimal wisdom, be limited by what the Father says? Do you see that? So that there's a diligence. You can imagine someone who's busy and talented and productive, and they're not doing anything that the Master had in mind. Right? A workman, perhaps, he goes out to build a building and doesn't match the plans at all. It's not even what was requested. Diligence? No. Because it's not limited to what the Master had asked for. So what Jesus did were those things that the Father asked about. The other reference here that's in both texts that I'll make a point about, and that's in verse 5 of John 9. He says, as long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. Now, parenthesis here. There's the image of night and day, and I'll come back to that in a minute because it has to do with deadlines. But in both passages, that image of the day drawing to a close goes and flows into another point that Jesus makes, which says there is a light in the world, and I am the light. And that's the guidance that should be followed. Look here in chapter 11 as well, verse 10. If one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. I think the picture is this. There's a light that represents what we should be doing. And Jesus says, I am the light. And that image is all through John. We've seen that. He's the light that came into the world. It exposes evil deeds, He says in some places. If you're not going to walk in the light, and you move out of that guidance, what God has commanded and what He has taught and what you know and have seen in the Father, of course now have seen in the Son, you're just going to stumble. You're going to make a mistake. You'll be lost, is what He's saying here in these texts. So He begins by saying, I'm here, I'm the light, we work while we can, but if you get out of the light, you're just going to be making a mistake and be stumbling. So it's a warning, really, to stay within the what that God has commanded us to do. And I think that's characteristic of the diligence of Jesus. What about the when? I was hoping these points, all starting with the same letter, would help everybody remember them. So parents can ask the kids, can you remember the 4 points, right? And it's the why and the what. You see, who, what, why, when, where. But anyway, it's the why first, and then the what, and then the when, and then this other strange one that's coming up. But the when. When did Jesus do the works? Look back again, John chapter 9, verse 4. I must work the works of Him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no man can work. Very parallel to John 11, where He says, are there not 12 hours in the day? Verse 9. If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of the world. There's this suggestion in both passages that there's a limited period of time. And I'll illustrate that as well. Just like when the big boss comes and gives you a job, seems real important. Mission is very important, right? Doing what the command implies is very important. But do you know what happens when there's a deadline? You know what I mean? And it's right pretty close, and there, you know, it's going to get dark and you can't work anymore, or the thing is due, or you're going to be embarrassed if you're not finished. Doesn't that motivate you? It makes you get going here. And there are so many things, really. Jesus Himself, as He lived among men, was working to a timetable. It was His timetable. The book of John also emphasizes my hour. The very first time you hear that's in chapter 2 when He's there at the marriage feast in Cana. Mary says, do something about this fact that the wine has run out. And He says, my hour isn't come yet. And He says that several times. But the point is that this clock is ticking. And the sand is running out until finally in chapter 13 He says, my hour's come. This is it. There was a certain period of time that He could work 12 hours in the day. Now wait a minute. How many hours are there in the day? It's not 12, it's 24. But His point is, there's only 12 hours of opportunity when you can see what you're doing. And after that, it comes to an end. And isn't it true in our life? Well, first of all, in our own lives, you know we're working to a ticking clock as well. We're all working to a time when the life that we have here is over. And it's judgment day. In fact, Jesus says some things about that. He says, I'll speak a minute about Jesus' timeline. He says, I'll be with you a little longer, then I'll go to Him that sent me, John 7:33. A little while longer, the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. And then John 5, which talks about really this end of time for us, another hour, not His hour, but our hour, is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear His voice, come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. Not only was Jesus working to a timetable, but we are too, in our own lives with regard to our own death and the judgment day at the end of time. You know, sometimes when we don't know exactly when the deadline is, but it's an urgent task, or I mean an important task, something real important, I remember that when we... when you're between jobs and you kind of worry about your health insurance or something, and you don't know that you're going to get sick, but you could. But somebody, that feels really urgent to make sure there's not a gap in between there. You know, so you work really hard to make sure. Sometimes not knowing the deadline makes something scarier because it may be real important. But I think in our lives, having a deadline, a time when things come to an end, and think about these applications that we have. I will do my best to talk about this, but we have relationships with people that come to an end. And that's the last chance you have to do what you needed to do, to reconcile, or to help them. That's the end. And children, you know, they grow up, and the time runs out, and they're away, and the opportunity to teach them is gone. And people whom you ought to have served pass out of your life, and they're not available. And relationships that ought to be healed, that they disappear and it's too late and you can't fix those things. Our lives are full of deadlines. And we have to work while it's light. There's 12 hours and then the night comes and nobody can work. It's over. Time runs out. And Jesus saw that. And He saw this opportunity when there's a man who was born blind from birth, and the questions arose, and He had to talk to the disciples about that. But it was an opportunity. It was an opportunity, and He took advantage of it then. That was the time to do it. And the same thing with Lazarus. And that brings us to our other point, which is the whatever. Whatever point. This sounds modern to me. It makes me feel a little bit younger. You know, you hear somebody and they say, well, yeah, but what about this? Oh, okay, whatever. You know, it's almost as if there's something that doesn't matter. That's kind of the idea. But I think that's really a key element of the diligence of Jesus, maybe even as important as any of the others. This is an interesting thing that Jesus was really just passing through, in a way. It's not clear how this relates to the last verse of the previous chapter here in John chapter 9, but it looked like he was kind of, you know, passing out of the temple, perhaps to get away from the crowds for his own safety. But as he was going, he passed this man born blind. And you remember we read the question that the disciples asked was, well, who was the reason for this? You remember Exodus 20, God said He visits His judgment on people for sin down to the third and fourth generation. So I guess somebody sinned. That's why this man is blind. He was born blind, though. That's kind of creating a dilemma. Well, did he sin? Did he do something in his mother's womb? Did he kick too hard? Or did he, you know, cause too much morning sickness? Or what was it? Or maybe he was going to sin so badly that he just deserved to be blind before he even had a chance to do it. Or maybe it was his parents' fault. But in which case, that doesn't seem right, does it? Because if his parents sinned, well, why would that be visited on the son, that he would be born blind? And so this dilemma, questions, and you can imagine all kinds of theological dilemmas. Jesus doesn't answer that question. And whatever brought it about, he just says, you know what? Neither one. You've got it all wrong. And in a way, he says, let's stop looking backward over here about what caused it, and let's look forward and see what we can do with this. And see if the glory of God can be revealed for this. And I'll just tell you, in our own lives, it may be that we say, why has this happened to me? Why was I born without an intact family? Why did I have these records of abuse? Why did I have this neighborhood that I had to come up with? Why did I have this health problem from the very beginning? Whose fault was it? My parents? Was it mine? The society's? Whose fault was it? Jesus is saying, I'm not answering that question. The question is, what are you going to do with this situation? Whatever happens, it's an opportunity for service. That's diligence, isn't it? Whatever the circumstances are, even if we don't understand it, and it doesn't seem to make sense, God has a plan, we don't know what it is, but that's the time for us to act. That's the very situation then that Jesus takes advantage of here in John chapter 9. Don't look back at the causes, look forward at what can be done. That's diligence, isn't it? Nothing stands in the way, and everything is an opportunity. Similarly, look over here in John chapter 11. I hope you're okay with me going back and forth between these two miracles, these two chapters. But here in chapter 11, remember that they had just tried to stone Jesus, and that wasn't lost on the disciples. But here's the death of a friend. And Jesus knows he's dying, and maybe knows that he's already dead as he delays 2 days waiting to go. Can he turn this another situation into an opportunity for the glory of God? But it wasn't lost on the disciples that Jesus was in danger if he returned to Bethany. You understand Bethany maybe 2 miles or less from Jerusalem. So it was really the neighborhood of where this previous threat had been. The disciples said, Rabbi, he said, let's go to Judea again, verse 7, John 11. Jesus says that. And the disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you. Are you going there again? And that's really the situation where in verse 9 Jesus says, hey, it's only 12 hours in the day. We've got to get it done. Got to get it done. You see the point? There's fear. There's danger. There's uncertainty. There's opposition. There's only 12 hours. You've got to do it. We've got to get it done. How often is it that our fear of what might happen stands in the way of these tasks we've talked about before? Of healing of a relationship. If I go and begin to treat my wife the proper way, boy, she'll just run all over me. She'll take advantage of that. We're afraid of something that stands in our way. That's the whatever. Whatever happens, we will do the work of God. It's what He's given us to do. If I talk to someone and they turn away or it spoils a relationship in my family or some other worry that I can think of and make up, they were lately wanting to stone you, the disciples said. Jesus said, it's time. There's only 12 hours. We've got to get this done. And he takes advantage of that opportunity. I think in our own lives, we have to be careful that our own fear, our own projection of what might happen, about how it's not going to work out like we thought, keeps us from doing what we're supposed to do. That's the diligence of Jesus. That he will do the work of the Father, whatever. Whatever. Whatever opportunity arises, whatever opposition or fear or danger is created there. I'm going to review, so you'll all remember the four main points. Why? He was sent by the Father. That's an important person to send you, and to reveal His glory, that's an important mission to do. What? Only the works of Him who sent Him. Only the words, only the plans, only the commands of the one who sent Him. When? Now. While it's day. While it's day. The opportunity is now. Don't put it off. And whatever, using whatever opportunities and despite whatever dangers to do it. There's another W. You don't have to remember this one. Those are the four main points. The question would be who? Who is to act this way, work this way, adopt the diligence of Jesus? It's an interesting reading here. And there are several other places in the book of John where Jesus goes into the plural and says, we say these things, but you don't believe it. The implication, especially in chapter 5, I think it is that the disciples are going to take up this work. And as we get on into the session, we call it the period of conference there before the crucifixion, Jesus said, prayed to the Father in chapter 17, for not only for those who believe because of my words, but also for these others who will create belief. There's this joint work that we have with Jesus, the same thing going on. Here in this text, it's like that too. In John 9, verse 4, in every translation except the one I was using, the New King James and the Old King James, which I suspect is the reason for keeping that, the best texts really say, we must work the works of Him who sent me while it's day. Night is coming when no one can work. Who is we? Who is we? I think Jesus is including in this picture here. Yes, I know, He will do the miracle. And He will reveal to us by His example what the Father wanted Him to do. But He's saying to us, this is our diligence to work the works of Him who sent Him, who sent Jesus while it's day. And I think that's our sense of diligence. And so I'll go back to the passages I might have used to begin the lesson and say that, you know, this sense of diligence then pervades the disciples as they go forward based on what they learned from Jesus. Paul said to the Romans in chapter 12, verse 10, not lagging in diligence, there's our term, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer. Here's the test. If you'll look at the yellow words and see which of the four W's that has to do with. Serving the Lord. That's why. Isn't it? Same idea. Patient in tribulation. Which one is that? That's the whatever. Whatever happens, we'll keep doing it. Another passage, Hebrews 6. We desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end, that you do not become sluggish, but imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. And that's the win. All the way to the end. Some more passages like that. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 16. If I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Divine imperative. Yea, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. That's why he does it. Acts 4, verse 20. There the apostles have been arrested, and they've been told not to preach anymore, but they say, we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? That's the what. Probably the whatever as well in that passage, right? Because of the persecution. The Holy Spirit testifies, this is Paul, as he's going toward Jerusalem, the prophecy is that he'll be bound there and put in chains. He says, the Holy Spirit testifies in every city saying that chains and tribulations await me. But none of these things move me, nor do I count my life dear to myself so that I may finish my race with joy, and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of the grace of God. Chains and tribulations, whatever. These things don't move me, Paul says. finish my race with joy. Work while it's day. There are just 12 hours, and then it's night when no one can work. And the ministry which I received from the Lord, that's why He does it. Because it's a commission that comes from the Master of the universe. You see, these texts really are the teaching of the apostles who learned about that diligence from the diligence of Jesus. And I think that's what He calls on us to do. Well, there's something we have to do to take advantage of the grace of God that we talked about this morning. And that is to listen to what God says. And the why is because the Master of the universe has asked us to do that. The what is very clearly defined in the New Testament. A person needs to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. To repent of their sins. And that means really make a change. A change not only in the specific sins that we do, but a resolution that whatever God asks us to do, that's what we will do. Confess His name before men. Confess that He's the Son of God. Start with that. With our words and with our mouth, confession is made. But then with our lives and what we do and the way we live. Baptism is the point in which sins are washed away. That's very clearly taught in Acts chapter 22, verse 16. And that's the action, the work that God has given us to do. The command, in fact, that He has asked us to follow in our diligent service to Him. If you need to do that and begin your diligent service, following the example of the diligence of Christ, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing.
Christ receive with sinful men, even